And I think we should start with group one again, which is Tom. And maybe we start with group two.
You're not coming back yet.
So group two has held a very active discussion. So active that we've covered only two examples, and we have time to cover everything. So we started with example two, which is the MPM reconciliation table, but very rapidly, in fact, discussed that reconciliation of MPM to IFRS-specified subtotals together or in contrast with the table in example three showing unusual items. And a number of comments were made, and I think what arose from the discussion is a certain difficulty in understanding separately the reconciliation to MPM, of the MPM on the one hand and the unusual items on the other. So that's a good sign for us that when we introduce those requirements, we have to bring clarity as to really the different objectives, the different scope of applications and the likes. Other than that, I think that the reconciliation of MPMs in that format would be deemed a useful tool for analysts, more especially when they include those tax effect, tax and NCI effects. Users accepting totally that these tax effects be estimated as can be done. Maybe out of the looking at the two tables together, a number of wishes expressed as to having the benefits of both tables for both. So, for example, in the reconciliation of MPMs, having indication of what lines in the income statement the items of reconciliation belong. And when coming to the unusual items, having the wish to see the tax effect of those, for example. Looking at the narratives accompanying the reconciliation of MPM, the question was really whether those narratives could be effective. And we got a sense that they could be effective. The risk of having boilerplate narrative was, in a way, unavoidable, but the guidance should be such that people are directed to explaining why, in economic terms, the management performance measure is relevant, the link to compensation, and more generally, how these performance measures are used for internally are deemed very valuable information, and the recommendation of having this kept concise was made. Discussion around the unusual items per se. So I already mentioned the tax effect information that would be considered useful by users. The sense also that it would be easier if all this information was found in the same place, so whether it would be possible to have, in fact, a single table rather than two. Finally, the important comment by preparers that not being able any longer to show an operating profit before unusual items directly on the face of the income statement would be a really backward step. If anyone in the group wants to supplement or correct what I said?
I think so.
yet.
I mean, I don't know whether this is for now or for the future discussion, but I just really wanted to leave the ISB with sort of like two strong messages. The first is please don't split the same information in a gazillion different ways across dozens of different tables, leaving the users to cobble it all up. If you can actually make it into one big matrix showing how everything comes together, that's so much more helpful, especially for people who don't maybe, you know, follow a company all the time. And the second thing is really that, you know, the tables, the way they're presented, you know, they're maybe great, but they're not always self-explanatory. So there always need to be some notes on how to read the table, what the individual cells mean.
Okay. I feel having two concepts of management performance measures and infrequent items or unusual items would lead to confusion for a reader when in MPM they also cover unusual items while reconciling. So I have a feeling that there could be overlap between MPMs and unusual items, and that will lead to more confusion rather than help to the user.
Okay, then we move to group one. Tom?
Oh, sorry for being late.
No problem.
So on question one, we managed to get through one and two. In general, the view was that it was useful, that the structure was right. Both, I think, the users and preparers thought so. One question that came up was for people who are doing functional, and you have to show nature that this may actually involve redesigning systems and stuff, and it may actually be costly, and we should think about timing of introduction. In general, some of our people were, there was a general of the users preferred nature, but not universally. And clearly, the users, though, if you were doing functional, they do really like that note on nature, so that was an important thing. The other thing in the structure, there was a couple of comments just on specific line items to make sure that all our lines are representative. They thought, for example, travel expense would not normally appear, so we want to have it look realistic. There was a little bit of discussion about the usefulness of not defined by IFRS and that disclaimer, and is it kind of a boilerplate disclaimer, and would it be really useful? And then on the MPMs, there was a lot of people liked the idea of MPMs being linked to a business model and the explanation showing that, and that would be useful. There was also a question came up, though, about excluding liquidity and ratios, and in particular, our group had a strong preference that some version of return on capital is really important, and that entities can define the numerator, the profit, and entities can also define the capital, and they can do so in an instructive way. And so there was a sort of a desire to think about including those measures, and in particular, I think return on capital seemed to be popular, but some mention of liquidity measures as well. And they also argued that these things could be audited and were very important to users. There's also a little bit of talking about how measuring growth. Let's see, have we got anything else? And the other thing that came up was there were concern that the NCI and the tax could be actually quite difficult to do. And there was some argument that if you were constantly doing something at a fairly high level up the statement of profit or loss, that the big thing was to be consistent year to year, and the purpose of that measure would define whether it was critical to get down to NCI and tax, depending what you're trying to convey. And so the argument was that we should maybe think about the NCI and tax in that particular case. I think that's kind of our, as far as we got. Because we didn't get to the third one.
Any further comments from group members? No? And group three, Tuck?
Thank you. We started from the example three, which is about unusual items. Actually, our group member said that the disclosure of unusual item is useful to understand the regular effect on the financial performance. However, the definition of the unusual item may be a bit debatable. Say the one of the member picked up the example of restructuring. So you have a restructuring this year 500, and next year 100, and then the third year zero, and then next year 400. So those kind of information could be useful, and then nobody can say whether or not you have a restructuring this year or next year. So it could be unusual things, but it may happen quite often. So then, if we have such a situation, the definition does not really cover such kind of useful information. So therefore, we have a struggle with the definition. And in order to avoid such kind of things, we could define the unusual using the by nature. But again, that is the debatable things. So there are some sympathy that we have such kind of a definition. That is what we have discussed. And it is quite difficult to fit the definition and the usefulness of this disclosure. And another typical example is a litigation. And the litigation is not really one of issues. Say, if you have one big litigation happened this year, it may continue for another 3 years. So the question is that an unusual item or not? So those kind of issues should be debated well. And then another thing pointed out is, like Francois picked up, if an unusual item is useful, then user want to know the tax effect on the unusual items. And also, somebody said the information on the cash flow effect should be also useful, because if the unusual item is useful information, user want to know what is the impact to the cash flow. And one comment from preparer's side was, if we were asked to disaggregate both by function and by nature, it would incur a significant cost. So they want to avoid, you know, showing the both by function and by nature. So that is the feedback about unusual item. We talked about a second question, which is about NPM. The question is whether it's burdensome or not. So for some preparers who is already doing it for EPS, it shouldn't be too much burden. But for those who are not doing that, maybe it could be quite burdensome. So then maybe the simple solution is to do the tax calculation or NCI calculation with just a simple matrix, rather than reconciling every detail of tax impact. So if we could provide such a, this can be done with a very simple mathematics, then it would be very helpful. And also, somebody picked up, if this is useful, then impact to the cash flow could be also useful. Also, as Tom pointed out, if NPM is useful, then there is a useful information about a balance sheet and ratio. So it should be allowed as one of the NPM, not only just a profit and loss statement. And one interesting argument is about the faithful representation. So whether or not it's a faithful representation, so it's a quite difficult issue. So if we stick too much to the faithful representation, then that may cause a significant discussion with the auditors. So we should be careful to use faithful representation. That is the feedback on the NPM. One more feedback on NPM is explanation about NPM is more important than just a number. So why do you think this NPM is important? Preparer has to explain it to users. Such kind of information is quite useful for the users. And also, if we change the NPM, preparer should explain it quite well. That is what user expect for NPM. And then lastly, we didn't have enough time, but just we discussed about total structure of the profit and loss statement. And the discussion was usefulness about the information on the integral associate, share of profit and loss of integral associates. Some member said it should be included in operating profit. But some member said as long as it is disclosed, then user can judge. So there was a debate, but we didn't have enough time to discuss any further. But one thing pointed out is to provide both by nature and by function is, again, very burdensome. That's all from us.
Okay, thanks, Chuck. Any further? Yeah.
When we talked about the cost of the by nature, by function, I think when we look in recent history where companies have spent an awful lot of money on the revenue standard, a lot of money on the lease standard, and then to think about the cost associated with this without truly believing a significant level of benefit, I think would be really difficult to have companies buy into. I think it all has to be taken into consideration. There's been a lot of cost lately.
Thanks, Sandra. Then we go to Gary.
Thank you. At our group, we actually got to all three questions, but in fairness, the last question unusual sort of a drive-by and buried in with MPMs. But we started with question one about the form and structure of the P&Ls. I would tell you, in general, I think the users in our group thought these are a big improvement forward, getting some discipline, some common structures, and so on. Actually, this is probably true through MPMs and usual as well. I think the preparers were asked more, can you do it, as opposed to you want to do it? And again, the sense is, yes, this can be done. And we did spend some time on functional versus nature, and but really didn't, other than why do you have by function and by nature in one thing, but if I only have by natural expense in the other, is why don't I have it by function, but we didn't really draw any conclusions on it. But again, I think the general sense is from the users in the room is this is a big improvement, the preparers is this can be done. Nonetheless, we spent a fair amount of time processing the individual line items in recognizing these are just examples to illustrate the concepts. But stepping back from the general discussion was it probably, we had to kind of go back and what exactly is the details we put in the examples, the application guidance, you know, that we'll publish in here to, and someone really said, well, travel expenses probably wouldn't make, so I think we just got a little bit refocused on what is the nature of the examples that we put out. There was a discussion about where's the effective hedging go? And my answer was, listen Monday morning, you'll find out. I explained the essence is when you've got derivatives and the hedging and stuff, it's to sort of line it up with the natural line item. If you're hedging an operational cost, it probably goes to operations. If you're hedging your capital cost, probably goes to financing and so on. But that's actually going to be voted on Monday morning. We had discussion about the details of what's in a functional P&L, and there was sort of general agreement in the room is that restructurings, although it's a by nature, should be on the face of a functional P&L, and by the way, so should restructurings. You know, we got into the theoretical construct that by function means by function, but there's certainly been discussion, and I expect there'll continue to be discussion, that how pure do you have to be on function, and if you're going to relax from it, how far do you relax? But there was sort of a across-the-board sort of discussion they should be allowed to be in the face of functional P&L. I think at the larger group meeting, someone had made the comment, what about private companies who don't have earnings releases and public statements? Why would they be out of scope? And I think there's a sense in our room that's a fair comment. Actually, we didn't think about it, as Aid had mentioned. I think we'll take that back and work it further in time. There was also a discussion about why is this limited to the P&L. Not so much the cash flow, but certainly a request that debt covenant EBITDA is a critical disclosure and should be someplace accommodated in our disclosures. The context here was in this project, but you know, broadly the point was that really is important. And your debt covenant EBITDA or adjusted EBITDA, why would that be, shouldn't be reconciled as well, you know, to the primary financial statements? And again, other than taking the message back, we didn't process it further. We also had a discussion about linking of the MTMs and the unusual items to the IFRS segment reporting. And again, I kind of stay tuned Monday's votes, but right now the recommendation, if you read the board papers, is there does not have to be the linkage. Nothing stops you from doing it, but we're not necessarily going to require it. There was a bit of a scance in the room about that probably should be a different answer than that, but we'll just, so there's comment letters to come. On it, I think in general there was agreement on the MPM scope, but keeping it to what the CEO, the CODM, how they talk about the company, that's a good scope and as good a universe as you could perhaps have. A little bit of discussion about unusual items. We do agree oftentimes unusual items are going to be an MPM. An MPM might not always be an unusual item. An example would be share-based compensation expense. Very commonly MPM'd out, but would not be unusual because they're persistent. And again, I think the sense was, you know, as we understand where you are on the definition of unusual, you might need to crisp it up a little bit more, and that's fine. And again, general support, I think, for why are we doing MPMs and unusual items. Same comment for unusual, but the discussion was more on MPMs and explained, and the room bought into. Is MPMs are here to stay, they're widely used. We bring discipline, some transparency, some linkage and reconciliation to the primary financial statements, and some discipline because it's presumed to be consistently applied, presumably the representationally faithful, and all the other IAS-1 and other requirements that we've got. There was a quick discussion, well, if you change your MPM, is that an accounting change? And I said, I think that's something that will come back in comment letters. But it was really came up clear if you're changing what is an MPM, you really got to be clear about it. And I think there was a sense also if something's an MPM, is your disclosures describing it, they should also make a disclosure. Is this tied to management or at least executive remuneration? And that's as far as we got. So it was a good meeting.
Okay, thanks, Gary. Any further comments to general topic from the group? And I said earlier that if you have any additional to the overall BFS project, Ian has left, so he has not a chance to. But Stephen.
I made a point for Ian then.
Okay.
And I'm making this point. I know it's repeating what people have said, but because we want to make sure that we get the message across on by function, by nature, the change from a standard cost in the system to a by... which I'll get it wrong around, by nature, it would be massively expensive. So an estimate that I would give, just to give a ballpark, is somewhere between 5 and 10% of market cap and 5 to 10 years. It's probably the most significant change that we would undertake.
In several years.
Which basis have you made this calculation?
On a basis of estimates to go to a different system.
across the board. First of all, you need to have a system developed which supports it.
Sorry?
First of all, you need to
Can you speak into the mic?
First of all, you need to have a system who supports it.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist today. And if you are doing, I mean, standard costing to, I mean, we had the discussion with Ian, how are you going to do that with standard costing?
This exists today.
Practically.
This doesn't exist.
Understood?
Can I ask you, Stephen, like, this was never intended to be such a huge change from current practice, because IS1 already requires analysis of expenses by nature, even if you report by function. But what IS1 doesn't do, it doesn't say you have to do all of your operating expenses, and this is the change we're introducing. But can you just, like, so you already have some natural analysis to comply with requirements today, not just you, Stephen, and the others who have made similar comments. Like, why is this so much harder than what you have to do today?
So for a manufacturing company or a company that uses standard costing, then overheads are allocated to inventory. So to split out changes in inventories, finished goods, work in progress, raw materials and consumables used is not information that is available within that system. So that's the example of the standard costing issue. So if it's breaking out administrative expenses, then that analysis probably would be available.
So things like staff costs, depreciation, amortization, is that an issue as well? Or is that something you do today and that's not
so some of those costs we identify separately. Mm-hmm. They would be included, but because there's already a requirement for those, then you would identify those separately. And you have payroll systems that can feed in and so on. It's really around the inventories where you have that major problem.
Yes, Stephen, can I give a reaction? Because I came from a standard costing company, too. The way I was thinking about it, and whether it works out this way, you know, whether it's done, is every expense in a company begins its life as a natural item. Then it rolls up from the lowest transaction points, whether it's subsidiary ledger or payables ledger or whatever. But right, it goes in a standard costing system. The way I was thinking of it, you know, the inputs, labor, material, plant, you know, overhead and so on, goes into it, and that becomes the items of your natural expense. Then you do need a line item, and they're changed from beginning to ending inventory, and that's why it's just assumed the natural expense is the expense. If you have a manufacturing, you disclose depreciation expense, but a lot of that will go into an overhead pool and be hung up in inventory and later in cost of sales. So I think if we can get there, that I allow what goes into the inventory systems, then beyond that, a net change in inventories, I think that should accommodate the concern.
I'm not sure, Gary, if everything goes in at a natural level. When we're initially booking, we might be booking to a cost order or maintenance order. So we would never have picked up service cost or repairs or
But every expense, disagree, starts off, goes to a payable system or a payroll system or a depreciation system. And I think you're probably down below the ledger to get the stuff. It's the source level.
You haven't distributed out to the function, right?
I'm sorry?
With that, you haven't distributed out to the function.
Well, no, the idea is you have total functional expenses and total natural expense. You're not trying to do this by line item. You're trying to do it in total.
But you're requiring here by line item.
No, we're not.
No.
In total. Take all your operating expenses by function, add them up. And that's some number, which sums in cost of sales, sums in over in G&A and so on. And then there's another column that's got by payroll, by rent, et cetera, et cetera. The idea is to agree at the total, not by line item.
What about companies that outsource a lot? Because I mean, how is it, does that make it more difficult, and is that analysis meaningful in the end? Because like a pharmaceutical company, I mean, they can, for example, do their clinical trials in-house, in which case they're going to have huge staff costs related to that, or they can go to a CMO. So if you outsource almost everything, then, you know, I don't know, would you just have a big chunk service cost and almost nothing else?
Well, and actually, the discussion, I used that today, and it's, you know, as someone, you know, whose understanding the reality is, today it's a payroll expense, tomorrow it's an outsourced service or a purchase service. I think, you know, the users have got to make the case, I need that, you know, as opposed to it's in cost of pharmaceutical development or something like that. It doesn't matter if it's internal labor or external labor. I think the user, the feedback, and they're going to have to demonstrate that's necessary to understand if it's done in-house or out-house by amount. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the limits. I mean, you're right, because stuff moves around. You know, when you outsource it, you hire consultants, you do it in-house, does it really change anything? In fact, if you outsource a function, they might be your retained labor coming back to the outsourcing company. Nothing's changed other than now it's purchased services. Those are acknowledged issues that have got to be worked in the course of this thing. We'll be looking for feedback on that.
Okay. Any further comments? Not the case. Then I have to say thank you for all your contributions today.
Thank you.
We have dinner at Zex at the Boysdale restaurant, which is not far from here, but it's in the first floor, if you're looking for that, on the second floor, and hope to see you all there. 6 o'clock starts with drinks. Otherwise, see you tomorrow at 8:30, April, 8:30.
Do you know where, when you're going? B-O-I-S-D-A-L. 5:45. Do you know where?
It's not that.
You come up.
That's not payroll.
From the Jubilee line, you walk through that little...